This is the Better Reading Podcast platform with stories behind the story, Jane's Be Better podcast, My Book Chat with Caroline Overington, and more. Looking for a particular podcast? Remember, you can always skip to it.
Welcome to the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story, brought to you by Belinda Audio. Listen to Belinda audiobooks anywhere, everywhere.
Hi, this is Cheryl Arkell from the Better Reading Podcast, Stories Behind the Story. We talk to authors about how they came to tell us their story. James Norbury, welcome to Better Reading.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Now, this is a slightly different focus for us. It's really about an illustrated audiobook. We're going to explain that to everybody. Okay. So James is a writer and artist. He began illustrating the adventures of Big Panda and Tiny Dragon, inspired by his Buddhist philosophy and spirituality, to share the ideas that have helped him through the most difficult times and in the hope that he can help others too. It's a charming illustrated story of two friends who travel through the seasons, sharing the lessons they learn on their way, and it has become a global bestseller. So it is slightly unusual that we go from an illustrated book to an audio book. So tell me a little bit about how the book came to be and why it's become an amazing audio book.
Well, the way the book initially arose basically was I'd studied these sort of Buddhist and spiritual principles for a long time, basically to help myself. And, they ended up becoming really useful to me. I went to volunteer with Samaritans. Are you familiar with Samaritans? But while I was working there, you can't advise people on the phones. So all the things I kind of learned that I thought, oh, maybe I could share some of these, you don't share them. You're not supposed to. So I thought, oh, that's kind of a shame. But anyway, so instead I decided to, I thought maybe if I started like a little spiritual group and I could discuss these ideas with people. But I'm not particularly outgoing in that way. And also there were, COVID happened around that time. So I thought instead I would draw illustrations because that's my job. I'm kind of an artist and a writer. And I thought I'd illustrate these ideas to make them accessible just in single panels so that they were quite quick to take in and digest. And so I made an Instagram of my pictures and that Instagram became very, very popular. So I decided I would take all the Instagram pictures I'd made and turn them into a little self-published book. And that little book became incredibly popular. And I sold so many of them, I didn't have time to do any writing anymore or any drawing because I was posting books all the time.
Running a business, really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, I'm also not very good at running businesses. I have a terrible record running businesses. So I decided to write to some agents instead and see if any of them were interested. And a chap called Ludo Cinelli, Eve White, he wrote back and said, yes, they'd be interested. And he put a proposal together and sent it out to publishers, as you do. And we had some offers and we went with Michael Joseph, which is a branch of Penguin. And that's how the book came to be, basically.
Incredible story.
Yeah, as to why it's so successful, I guess I think fundamentally I was quite open-hearted with it. So I would look at my own problems, the way I suffered, basically, and try and work out ways out of that suffering that worked for me. And then I would be very honest and explain my problem, explain the solution I'd come up with, and then I'd draw about it, if you like. And so it was very sort of heart on my sleeve thing. And I think I found out that fundamentally we're all so incredibly similar that all the problems I have, most of us have. So the solutions that I sort of tended to come up with work for most people or at least help most people in some way. So yeah, basically we're all very similar. I think that's why it's successful because it helps most people.
Yeah. I had a particularly tough year last year and the year before. My mother died, and then it became like a domino effect of, you know, terrible things happening. So my mother died. We're a family of six kids. We discombobulated. So everybody just, you know, fell apart. The matriarch had gone. We lost our anchor. And then I got seriously ill last May, and I was told that really it's just a couple of days, right? And I got out of that. I was one of the lucky people. It didn't end up being what they thought it was going to be. And here I am, fit and healthy, and nothing's wrong with me anymore. But the depth of darkness that it takes to get out of the other end is really, really tough. Now, I have always been cynical of what I call woo-woo. Right.
I know what you mean.
And it's one of those things where people often say to me that it's just not you to dig deep or to follow a Buddhist regime or whatever it could be. I've just never been one of those people. I've been always very pragmatic, very practical. You know, if you want to fix something, you do it yourself, you know, blah, blah. But that hole was too big for me to fix myself. And it was really interesting in how I crawled my way out of it and all the things that I drew on, right? And what I think fundamentally, and this is where your book comes in, I drew on the advice and experience of other people like yourself who I didn't even know, who helped me get through it. And that's what's so important, isn't it? Those connections.
Yeah. Because we have a tendency, I think, to lose those connections in the way we live at the moment. Well, a lot of us are quite isolated and our communities have broken down and we stay in our houses. And so where do you get that support? And maybe I help you via a book, you help me via a podcast, even though we may never meet each other, but we help each other. And exactly. So,
but even your reference, like talking about what you started doing on Instagram, now social media gets a flogging, and we all know the pitfalls of social media. We absolutely do. But that, and there is so much good in some of it that is out there in terms of connection. Like if you find what's right for you, it actually really works for whatever it is you need in that moment.
Mm. Yeah, I think social media is kind of like a tool, like a hammer, and you can go out and you can build a shelf with it, or you can hit someone on the head with it. You know, it's not the social media that's the awful thing; it's the abuse of it, if you like, and the misuse of it. But it can be wonderful. I mean, like especially as I say, when we're so isolated. If you live in a small village and you want to begin. I don't know. So you want to begin a Buddhist practice, it'd be really difficult, but you might well find a little group online that you could, be part of.
And you might find, you know, discovering James Norbury on a podcast and somebody's listening at this very moment and they, you know, went through what I went through last year or what you've gone through and boom, there's that connection. And there's not really a wall, like there's no barrier to engaging with it.
That's one of the things in a way is even if you and I did know each other in person, say we were neighbors, there's a good chance we would never discuss these things because they're too deep for passing conversation. But because of the nature of the social media and the podcast, we're instantly talking about something relatively deep, which we would talk about if we were in the supermarket.
that's exactly right. Because when we're in the supermarket, we're not looking for it. We're not looking for that relationship or that connection. I find that it's when you're home alone and you're in your own head or you're in a hospital bed and you think, oh my God, how the hell did I get here? They're the times that I think, you know, you pick up your phone and something magic might happen, or you read a comment or a message that somebody sent you. You know, I'm often teased for not being woo-woo. One of my great colleagues, Jane, often teases me. But I think in a way we all are, we just don't know. Like I swim. And so then I guess I've always thought that was just the physical, right? But it's not. It's more than that. You know, you're in a pool, you're hearing the lapping, the water hitting your body, and it's meditative in a way. And since then I have recognized that that's what it's doing for me as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I do karate, and that has a similar effect. It's so not difficult, but you have to be so focused when you do it
that that's you're right.
in a different state of mind. When you step into a dojo, you kind of, everything else goes boom and disappears for an hour. It's a lovely experience, you know. Mm. It's another good reason to do it, a different form of help than you'd expect, but still a very valid one, isn't it? Yeah. Mm.
So audiobooks have been something that I've been particularly fond of for a long time, and podcasts, but I had a dog who also died last year.
I know.
I had him for 17 and a half years. But anyway, what I was listening to would dictate the length of my walk.
Right.
So I would get addicted to audiobooks, podcasts, whatever it was. And again, and I've been in the book industry a long time and I've been reading hard copy forever. I'm an old-fashioned kind of person. Mm. However, what I got from audio, again, is very different because I felt a sense of intimacy with the person that was talking.
Mm.
Don't you think? Like there's something about, I mean, it happens with radio too, don't you think? There's something about listening to somebody's voice.
Mm. Yeah, I guess, and also, I mean, I've been lucky, the people who've read my audiobooks, they're, you know, really accomplished at what they do. And I think they add a whole other dimension to it that I was honestly quite emotional when I listened to the audiobook versions of my books, because it's somebody else adding their whole skill set to my skill set and creating something even greater than the two individual items. And it was really beautiful. I was, I'm super, because I'm not really a big audiobook person on the whole. I tend to read paper copies and things. But when I listened to it, I was quite bowled over and quite taken aback by how effective and beautiful and immersive as well, I suppose. It's ever so immersive.
Mm. So when you're listening to your own book, you immerse yourself in that story, even though you know it inside out.
Yeah, it was very different. It's like listening almost to a different book, like I could, like someone else had written it almost. It was, you listen to it. What was nice is it came across so differently to how I'd always read it in the past. It was like listening to something else. But I was like, oh, this is good. Sounds terrible, I know that. But I was like, I was quite relieved because I got to the end and I thought, oh, that's really good. I'm proud of that, of what myself and the narrator have accomplished.
Yeah. So that doesn't sound terrible, because you don't want to be listening to it and thinking, oh my God, that's terrible. You want to be listening to it. So tell me how that happened, how the transition happened, because it's an unusual book to become an audio. Talk to me about that and how you felt about, because you're right, in a sense, it's giving up some of your art and really giving it over to somebody else.
With the first book, because it is a complete series of standalone and really unrelated images, the only thing that unites them is the characters and the vague theme. They're in all kinds of different locations and so on. What I did was I actually kind of created a whole new narrative that sort of wove the pictures together. And for 90%, I managed to create a story that blended the pictures in the order they appear in the book and leave them pretty much untouched. Some pictures had to be moved back and forth throughout the book to sort of keep a coherency. But you wouldn't just want 160 separate cut-off sentences. That would be very jarring and not very nice to listen to, I don't think. So, yeah, I worked on weaving it into a tale to make it. And I tried to sort of describe all the settings. So whereas the picture would just have the speech, when I did the audiobook, I would say, like, it's a misty day. You can just see, you know, the mountains are just peering through the clouds. A bird sings, big panda walks into the, and so on. So to make it, so sort of describe to the reader what would be happening in the art so that they can get a feel for what would be happening if they were reading the book.
Mm.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
And what about in terms of choosing the reader? Did you have a say in that? Was there voices that you listened to and thought, oh, no, that's not it, you know, or this is the voice for me?
I did. I wanted it to be read, because the way I write is quite traditional, almost slightly like old fairy story style. I don't write in a particularly modern way. And so I thought it would be better read traditionally with like an old world accent, something sort of British, I suppose. It just in my head, that's how I saw it, I suppose. I don't know why. But I was quite concerned about accents, because I didn't want somebody to give the dragon a funny voice or the panda a funny voice. But yeah, they looked at a few different people, but they chose, you know, in the end, the chap we went with, he's, you know, a really good, very solid, nice, rich voice. And he just added inflection to the, if that's the right word, just so he slightly deepened his voice for the panda, slightly raised his voice for the dragon. And so he didn't do comedy accents or anything like that. So I think he did a really, really lovely job. Mm. Jason Isaacs, his name is. Yeah, he did it. He was ever so sensitive and to what was going on. Yeah, I was really pleased. I think they did a great job picking him.
Mm, absolutely. Hey, do you want to tell us about, you know, how you came to writing, like some of the experiences and what kind of hardship you were experiencing that you wanted to share with people? Or were you wanting to share, or were you wanting to kind of, for you, having an outlet, but also, I guess, seeking comfort through others? Talk to me about how that came.
Do you mean writing in general or writing the panda and dragon things?
Writing the panda and dragon. Like, what is it that you were kind of going through?
I don't know. I just, it's quite hard to pin down. It's not what you would call depression, but I spend quite a lot of time in a sort of general sort of, I think you call it a malaise or something like that. Just feeling very sad at the world. Mm-hmm. I'm very into animal rights and nature and the protection of nature and things like that. And it absolutely breaks my heart to see what we do as a species to the planet, to each other. I find it really hurtful inside. And I went through long periods of my life where I would see it everywhere. So when I would see cars and I would like hate them for what they were doing, and I wouldn't see a car. I would see factories and metal presses and mines and, you know, plastics and oil rigs. I would just see all the sort of destruction and then the greed that we have that goes along with it, that we keep wanting all this new stuff. So we just rape and pillage the world until it's dust, until we get all the toys that we want. And I would see that everywhere, and it became very, very depressing. And I don't know if that really explains it, but that when you live with that all the time, it really drags you down.
I understand completely. Yeah.
Oh, well, that's good. I'm not good at explaining it. So obviously that doesn't do any good. Like it does you no benefit just to sit around and mope at the state of the world. So, well, then, try and change some things then, you know, be proactive rather than just moaning about it. So I thought to myself, right, well, what will be the best thing you could possibly do? And I think, well, I don't think that, you know, content, if you like, let's say more spiritual or more enlightened souls are as damaging to the world, because maybe we're not. So I thought, well, how can we make more gentle souls in the world? And I thought, well, you know, by sharing wisdoms that amplify our gentleness. And so that's what I tried to do, because I thought that's attacking the source of the problem, you know, rather than going through the streets with placards or telling people not to drive cars or something. Not that I hate cars. I don't actually hate cars. It's just the way my brain worked at the time. So I thought, if I can get to the root of the problem and create more gentleness and more compassion in the world, there would be less horrors performed. And that, obviously that's a hugely ambitious objective, but I was told by one of the people at Penguin that we've sold over 1 million copies now. Mm. So it is doing something, you know, it is, however small effect, it is creeping out there and you know, hopefully having at least a small ripple for good.
Mm. Well, 1 million copies would be doing that. Do you know, I went during COVID and the lockdowns, and in Australia, we very, very strict lockdowns. So it was a tough time for people, and particularly people that lived alone like I did. But one of the things that kept giving me a little bit of hope was that we stopped, no cars on the road, no planes in the air, so many things stopped. And I had a friend who got caught in transit. He was flying home to France, and he ended up, because of what had happened, the lockdowns, he ended up in a hotel, I think it was in Kuala Lumpur, and it was by a park, and he ended up being in that hotel room for months. And he watched all the animals come back to the park in that stillness of people not being in there. And he said every day there would just be more and more animals back in that park, you know, native animals or, you know, all sorts of animals. And that was such a beautiful image for me. I just loved to hear that, you know. So when it was over, I was really hoping that we might have taken on some of that change or embraced it, but it didn't happen. Like the very next day, we went back to what we were doing. And that was an opportunity, I think, where we could have thought, okay, well, you know, maybe we should consider the way that we're living, but it didn't happen.
No. My wife, Ruth, she said the same thing. We were only allowed, we had quite a serious lockdown. We were allowed to go out like once a day for a little walk. And we used to walk around the university. Swansea's got a big university campus, and we would walk around it and it was abandoned. It was like, a post-apocalyptic film. Mm. All the grass was growing between the flagstones and all the, it was quite amazing, quite sort of sobering in a way. And I remember walking through the park with her, and she said to me exactly what you just said. He said, I wonder if people will take this as a lesson and we'll learn from it. And as I said, the way my mind went before it, nope, of course we won't. We'll go straight back to Primark or whatever and buy cheap trainers because that's what we do.
We went back immediately. There wasn't even a thought given, nothing.
Like nothing happened, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so do you think that from now on that this is who you are in terms of an artist, as a writer? Is this the path that you want to take?
No. I mean, I love doing this work, but now I do loads of different things. I like painting abstracts. I do graphic novels. I do stained glass.
Wow.
Yeah, I do all kinds of painting. I like I do a lot of very dystopian art. There's things on my walls behind me. Those are my paintings. So I do all kinds of things: etchings, prints.
And how is it that you came to be an artist? That you came to be a writer and an illustrator? Talk to me about just what it is like when you were younger and growing up. Most kids, if you ask them what they want to be, it's kind of like a profession that's tangible, you know, like a nurse or a doctor or a lawyer. What is it that you thought that you would be?
I always wanted to be a park ranger.
Oh, wow, lovely.
Yeah, I wanted to save the animals. I wanted to,
So you've had it in you for a long time.
That's what I always wanted to do. I always wanted to save the animals from when I was very young. I went to university to study zoology so I could save the animals, completed a degree, found out afterwards that I'd been misadvised and that was completely the wrong degree and I'd wasted 3 years. But, yeah, that was a pain. But, I ended up not really being able to be a park ranger due to various circumstances. So I went back to writing and art, which is what I also always done that. My father was an art is an artist. He's a sculptor, and he's quite successful. So that like taught me from a very young age that you can be an artist and, you know, make a normal income or a good income. He did very well. He's a very good sculptor. And so that's very useful because you need to believe it's possible.
It's got to be tangible, right? You've got to, you know, I think as a child, you've got to see that it's tangible, you know, because often writers tell me, writers of fiction, that, you know, when they were little, they loved reading, but they didn't ever think they could be them, that they could be the writer. I think that's changing a little bit now too.
I think the world of self-publishing certainly opens up a lot of doors for people who can't get their work looked at by agents and things, doesn't it? But I've never really had a proper job. I worked in a jeweler's for like 6 months after I left university.
What, selling diamonds?
Yeah, diamonds and watches. I was quite good at it, actually. I enjoyed it. But then I decided not to do that. And I thought, right, I'll you know, be an artist and a writer. I was shockingly unsuccessful. Like really, really bad. I think I did quite good work. I'm quite lucky. I'm one of those artists. I actually like the pictures I paint. You know, I think they're quite nice pictures, but I'm shocking at business. So I would paint my pictures, stick them on my wall like they are there, and then expect people to buy them. And go, why is no one buying my work? I put it on Facebook. Surely they should buy it.
Exactly.
And the same with my writing. I would write a novel, finish it, send it to a couple of agents. It would get rejected. And I'd be like, well, stuff that. I'll write another one. I wouldn't keep sending that same novel. I was not persistent at all. And I would just think, I'll write another novel and this one will be better. And then they'll have to take it. So I've got lots of novels that I've written. But yeah, I was really, really unsuccessful. Yeah, I spent pretty much my entire life up to about 3 years ago living. Our combined interest, my and my wife's combined income was lower than the minimum wage in this country. We lived well below the poverty line. But, you know, we were quite happy and messed around, did our thing. I've always been quite uncompromising and always insisted that I would be able to pay my way by painting and drawing and writing.
I read something recently, it was on Instagram, I think, and it was a photographer posted it saying that I wouldn't be an artist if there was something else I could do. I thought that was quite funny because in a way, once you are that, you can't be anything else. You can't do anything else. Yeah.
I have these sort of worlds in my head that I have to express. They have to come out, whether it's writing or drawing. I have to get the images in my head out into the world. And if I did a different job, I wouldn't be able to do that. And I'd like feel like I was going to pop. Yeah. So.
But, you know, just getting back to doing something and saying something in the state of the world at the moment and what's happening in Gaza, I don't know how closely you've been following that. My parents are Lebanese and I have felt absolutely compelled to do something really quite vigorously, and I just can't be silent about it. And it's the first time in my life where I've put myself out there to that degree because for whatever reason it's become so polarizing. And I think that it's helping the cause, definitely. Or we're trying to, but also it's been an outlet for me, you know, and I think that that's really important that people do speak up about whatever it is they're passionate about.
I think so. I think it's very bad for you to sit in your lounge complaining about the world and doing nothing about it. I think it just makes you more angry and more mad. As soon as you start doing something, however small, I think at least you feel like, you know, you're trying, and your soul appreciates it somehow. And something I try and do is I think if everybody did what I did, would the world be better or worse? And you putting yourself out there for your beliefs, if everyone in the world was, you know, putting themselves out for a noble belief, things would change very quick, I'd like to think.
Yeah.
I'm a big believer in that your actions shouldn't be harmful to others. So,
oh, of course, yeah.
You know, so I think that if you're going to go and, you know, put yourself out there and try and make a difference or something, you should try and do it in a way that's not going to hurt anyone or anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the fact is, like, when you're doing something like that, however tiny, you're part of the solution. I always thought, you know, it's like there's a brick wall there and you have the choice to chip a tiny bit off the wall, ignore the wall, or put a brick, another brick on top of it.
Mm.
And I'd rather chip off a tiny piece of the wall than the other two options.
Mm.
If we all chipped a tiny piece of the wall off, it wouldn't be there. Mm. You know, maybe that's a bit idealistic, but
yes, no, I hear you. Yeah. Well, James, what a lovely piece of work, and the audio is fabulous. Thank you for your time today. It was really lovely to chat.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you. Thank you for your time as well, and for thinking of me, because it's been really nice.
Thanks.
If you'd like more information about Better Eating, follow us on Facebook or visit bettereating.com.au.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Belinda Audio. Belinda audiobooks are available on CD and MP3 from online booksellers and bookshops everywhere, or you can download from Audible, Google Play, or the iBook Store. We've also created our own app called BorrowBox that's available from both the App Store and Google Play. All you need to do to get it working is to download the app, join your local public library, and you'll gain access to the world's best collection of ebooks and e-audiobooks available for you to loan on your phone or your personal device. Belinda, we're here to enable you to escape, imagine, grow, and be inspired through the power of storytelling. Belinda Audiobooks. Anywhere, everywhere.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pile-ups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
If you enjoyed this podcast, leave us a review and check out the other podcasts on the Better Reading Network.